This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to the Ghost Bunny Podcast. I'm your host, Bridget Marquardt, with a brand new episode for you. I am here again with Dr. Elizabeth Yuko, and today we are going to be talking about the Victorian ghost stories that I was telling you all about and a little bit about Lizzie Borden. Because the way we ended our last episode, we were talking about haunted travels and all of those things. And one of the places you went to do that article was the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast.
Yes, I did not stay overnight. I'm not that brave. But I did do the daytime tour, which was fascinating. And my very first article for Rolling Stone actually was on Lizzie Borden and why we're still fascinated with this murder so many years later. And, you know, why we're still visiting her house this many years later. And after interviewing a bunch of different experts, some who are familiar with her story, one psychiatrist. It's a few different reasons that explain why we're still interested. One being she was a woman who was accused of carrying out a very grisly double murder. And a Victorian, because the murder took place in 1892, so the tail end of the Victorian era. And she was a single woman. So that was, she was already deviating from the norm because she wasn't married, but she was a church-going woman. She was a member of the Fruit and Flower Society, an upstanding citizen. And to have this picture of Victorian womanhood and femininity even considered to be a suspect of murdering her father and stepmother with a hatchet was sensational then and still is today, especially because at the time, if you were a woman and you were going to murder someone, you usually went with poison. That was the easier. There are a lot of problems with poisoning somebody, but as it became easier to determine if someone was poisoned, that became less of a popular murder technique. But, you know, that was one reason. It was also one of the first major media trials in the country. So you had members of the press in the courtroom reporting on every move. If she yawned one day, then they would report that, oh, she looked bored. She must have done it, because if you could be bored during this trial, you must have committed the murder. It's tricky reporting on the case today, because so much of what was written at that time, which normally we would use as part of the historical record, was sensationalized, in some cases just fabricated. So that makes it extra tricky. And even though they didn't live, their house was upper middle class, they could have lived in a fancier part of town, but Andrew Borden and her father opted not to. He was a frugal man, and they lived in this house with without hallways, where one room connected to the other. But to people reading the story and following along, it looked like an upper class or upper middle class Victorian family that had turmoil. And it's a Schadenfreude, basically, is look what this, you know, the people who are supposed to be upstanding citizens, look at what they're up to. So yeah, they sold the B&B because I covered that as well a few years ago. But and I think the same people were either considering buying Maplecroft, the house that Lizzie and her sister Emma lived in after the murders. I'm not sure what exactly happened with that. But yeah, it's kind of everything we were talking about in terms of why women were mediums and, you know, the leaders of the spiritualism movement being passive, quiet, sensitive, emotional. You see the exact opposite of that in the Lizzie Borden case, at least in terms of what she was accused of. And oh, and it's an unsolved murder because ultimately she was acquitted and the murder was never officially solved. And so we love a mystery, and that one technically still is a mystery today. Have you had a chance to visit?
It is still a mystery, and I have gone to visit. I've gone twice, but I haven't gotten to spend the night. It is on my itinerary for next year to spend the night. I think the girls from the Morbid podcast and I are going to try and do it together, which would be so much fun.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on what happened? Have you done research on the evidence or anything like that? And do you have any conclusions?
I still don't know. I mean, there's so many kind of not behind the scenes stories, but, you know, questions of whether her father was abusing her. And, you know, we know he was strict. We know he wanted her to behave a certain way. And whether or not he abused her, I don't know. And not that murdering someone's ever okay, but I think it's a slightly different story if you're dealing with someone who has abused you for years versus just waking up one morning and being like, I think I'm going to hatchet my dad. So, you know, it's slightly different than that. I liked how the tour guide, when I visited, they also kept their, I don't know if she actually had an opinion or not, but they gave the tour completely neutral without really kind of trying to cloud us one way or the other. I mean, there are no other suspects. I think if there was another person where it was really plausible that it was them, or there was some other really good explanation, then it might be different. But yeah, I also don't want to accuse people of murder. I don't know, but it would have had to have been some type of, I don't know what kind of force to do it when, other people weren't in the house who weren't accounted for. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's very crazy. A lot of the things that happened, that like her dress and burning her dress out back, unless that isn't true. So I'm only going off of like stories that I know of. And I don't know if they're all 100% true, but if she was, her alibi didn't really pan out. And then she did some really suspicious things right after, like burning the dress that supposedly had red stains all over it and things like that. I feel like, well, that's a little weird.
Yeah.
So I lean towards she did it. But then I've also heard stories about, was it like her uncle was like kind of staying at the house or coming to visit, or was he the traveling salesman, or was that two separate people? There was like another man who was like in the house who like was, and then like left right after. And there was a little bit of suspicion on that person too. And I thought, okay, well then that does interest a new character, and maybe he had something to do with this.
Yes, I think it was her uncle. It has been a while since I reviewed the facts of the case, but I think maybe he left before the murders happened, or there was something that I remember thinking like, okay, I don't know. Like he didn't jump out as definitely he did it, or you know, but at least there is another figure in there.
Yeah. And then as far as like the paranormal aspect of it, like when I feel like when tragedy happens like that, like so abruptly and everything, that's usually a lot of times why there's paranormal activity in a place. And if somebody really loved a house or had a lot of attachment to a place like Lizzie might have had, it might be a reason why her presence is still there. But there's also some tragic history that happened next door that supposedly is a lot of the paranormal activity that happens in the Borden house as well with children.
Oh, God, I don't think I know about what happened next door.
Yeah, there was like some tragedy with two little, I think it was two children were died next door. And a lot of people experience paranormal activity from kids in the Lizzie Borden house, which people thought was kind of weird because there weren't children there, but it's coming from next door, supposedly. And then there's also a cat ghost at the Lizzie Borden house, which is amazing.
That does sound familiar. Because I think, wasn't there a cat with her out in the barn at some point?
I'm not sure, but I do think she had a cat. But there is a cat ghost. And then not only that, but when I was there, and he's probably gone now, but there was a cat that lived at the Lizzie Borden house. I think his name is Max. I could be wrong on that. Did you meet, it was a black cat that hangs out at the house?
I think there was a cat there, yeah.
Yeah, so that's so cool. And you met the previous owner, and I think she has passed away too.
That sounds about right. Yeah, it definitely is not the new owner. The tour guide we had, who wasn't the owner, but had worked there for years, she was telling us about some of the experiences that she's had in the house, of which there are many. The scariest one was, she said that when she's giving tours, and if she is very careful how she speaks about Andrew Borden, because if she says anything that even hints that he wasn't a great person, she feels like someone's choking her and like can feel hands around her neck strangling her. That, I mean, so she said, I'm not going to say anything bad, and here's the reason why. And I thought, okay, well, nobody else will either now. But yeah, and she's had other experiences in some of the different rooms. I think the room with the kind of sofa where Andrew Borden was murdered, she's had experiences, I think, in that room, as well as Bridget, the maid's room upstairs. Mm-hmm. I think with that one, or maybe that one, I think they, because they have guests staying in there, that guests have complained about weird cold patches or cold areas of air, lights turning on and off, that type of thing, that it's not a popular room to stay in for that reason.
I've heard a lot of people have experiences in that room. I can't wait to spend the night, but you were talking about how the layout, and I've never actually talked to anybody about this, but the layout is so flipping weird in that house. The downstairs is pretty normal, like whatever, for like a Victorian house. It's very, you know, chopped up as houses were like back in those days. But then when you get upstairs, you're absolutely right about there not being any hallways. Like the rooms just adjoin to the other rooms. So in order to get to one room, you have to walk through somebody else's room to get to that room. And it's like so bizarre.
Yes. And so that itself wasn't hugely unusual, especially for someone who was as frugal as Andrew Borden. And so I don't know if that's exactly why he did it, but it was a way to save money, because hallways aren't living space. And so you could have bigger rooms if you don't have hallways. And so it would make sense if he did it for that reason. Another theory is that it was just another way for him to have control over his daughters and anyone who's in the house, because you can't go anywhere without other people knowing about it, based on where your room is. I mean, it also makes for an awkward B&B in the modern times, because I don't really know how that works. Like, if you're staying in a room, do you just have strangers walk through your room if they have to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night? Like, I'm not entirely sure how that works.
I think you do have people walking through your room. I think it's the only way, and it's so strange. And I think that you have to know that there's tours at certain parts of the day, and they'll be walking through your room as well.
That would make sense. But I guess it just makes the house more interesting. And, you know, when you're going on a tour, you're trying to piece the story together. The tour guides are telling you their take on it. And you're just thinking, you know, that's just another piece to it that you're going from room to room. It's a strange layout. It's a little bit creepy. Yeah, I think that kind of all adds to the mystique and intrigue of a place like the house in Fall River.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting, too, because they really embrace all of this. So they rent it out. They let paranormal investigators do stuff there. The tour talks all about the murders. The couch, it's not the couch that Andrew was murdered on, but it's a replica that's in the room and supposedly where it was in the room. They even have like fake axes that you can like lay on the couch and take like a picture with an axe and everything. So they really, really embrace all of this.
They do. They have annual Lizzie Borden reenactments. So they have actors come in and reenact things. And, someone is making mutton stew and then other people are getting sick from eating the mutton stew and all of that. I did get a T-shirt in the gift shop that says everything I learned about anger management I learned from Lizzie Borden, which I couldn't resist. The gift shop is an interesting place. They have Lizzie Borden bobbleheads, really anything you could think of. So, they really did. They did not shy away from that part of their past and the people coming, to learn about it.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
And you must be familiar with the nursery rhyme, Lizzie Borden took an axe and I forget which way it goes. It gave her a mother 40 wax, and when she realized what she did, gave her father 41 or whatever, something like that. As somebody who does a lot of stuff about, writes a lot of stuff about history and everything, what do you think, why do you think that is something that little kids sing and talk about and was made into like a nursery rhyme?
I think a lot of children's nursery rhymes and songs are a lot darker than we think they are. And that one certainly is. That one, I guess, is more a little bit more obvious about it being about a murder. But I don't think kids really think about what they say and sing and recite. And it's catchy or rhymes. And so I feel like it's, yeah, like other nursery rhymes that might be about, I don't know what, I'm not sure what's fact and what's fiction, but you always hear about certain nursery rhymes being about the Black Plague or, you know, stuff like that we're singing about, or, you know,
Ring Around the Rosie.
Ring Around the Rosie, or like Rockabye Baby, like a baby's gonna fall out of a tree. Like, you know, we're seeing this like, goodbye, baby. If this branch breaks and you fall to your death, I hope you're okay. You're like, we say messed up things to kids a lot.
I just think that maybe that's another good topic for an upcoming episode. I just think that all the kids' nursery rhymes that have these like really dark meanings to them or are from a dark place are just fascinating, and that they are perpetuated generation after generation. And I was singing about Lizzie Borden when I was like a little kid. I didn't even know what I was talking about, but like I'm singing about a woman murdering her parents and nobody thinks that that's weird.
Yeah. I guess if it rhymes, it's fine. I'm not sure what our mentality is, but it's probably not something parents are teaching their kids. It's probably something that, you know, kids are teaching each other on the playground or wherever kids hang out these days. Yeah. But yeah, I also remember that was absolutely a thing growing up that people would say. And we knew it was a little bit bad, or there was something a little controversial about it, but like we certainly didn't know the history behind it.
Definitely not. Did you get a chance to go over to Maplecroft?
We drove by the outside, but that was it.
That's what I did too. And I went to the cemetery where they are buried.
Oh, I think we may have done that also. I was with a friend of mine and her husband, and I mean, he's a friend of mine too. Yeah, so somebody else was driving me around, so I didn't want to make too many requests, like, and let's stop here. But they were very nice.
You were talking about like what makes this case so popular still to this day. And I mean, definitely all the things that you were talking about. And the last thing though, that you were saying is that how it's an unsolved case. And I think that is really one of the things that intrigues people, at least for me. That's what intrigues me so much. Like I love it, but at the same time, I can't stand that there's unsolved cases like the Lizzie Borden. Like, I just need to know, did she do it or did she not do it? And I don't even care if she did it or didn't do it, but I need to know, like, I just need the answer. And like Jack the Ripper, like, I need to know who did that. I need to know who was responsible for that. The Zodiac, I need to know, like, I don't know why I need to know. It doesn't really make a difference in my life, but it's one of those things where I can't stand that it's unsolved.
Yeah. It's, and part of one, well, there's a lot of reasons certainly why it's unsolved. But one of the things I learned on the tour was that after the murder, people were coming in, neighbors, townspeople, they were coming in and just looking around the house, and they were basically tampering with a crime scene. So, I mean, it's not like forensic technology was amazing in 1892. But the police would at least had more information and more pieces of the puzzle if people hadn't come in and, you know, rummaged through things, looked at the crime scene, maybe taken souvenirs. So that was another kind of major reason why there are so many unanswered questions, is that maybe there was some key piece of evidence that was tampered with or taken that we don't know, and the whole thing would have been solved that day. But we'll never know. Well, maybe not that we'll never know. And I think that that's part of it too, is that, you know, we like the idea of us possibly being the people to solve it. Like, really, realistically, the average person we're probably not going to solve anything. But technically, maybe we went over all the evidence. We're going to be the ones who find that one thing that everybody else overlooked. And just, that's really appealing. And fun, really, for people, even though it's a murder. So I think that that's part of it, too. The idea that maybe I'm the person who solved it. I mean, I don't think I'll be the person to solve it, because there's so many blanks. But yeah, I think that keeps us coming back. Whereas if it was a solved case, then we wouldn't necessarily be poring over the details. And like, did she burn her dress? Where were their ashes? Was she in the barn with the pigeons before, you know, tracking her every move of the day, like we are, and having reenactments in this whole, you know, play by play of what went on that day. But yeah, because we don't know what happened, we do want to know every detail.
Yeah. I can't remember. So they never found the axe, right?
Oh, I don't think so. Or maybe they found the handle. God, I am totally blanking on that.
I think like a ton of years later, and I'm just saying a ton because I don't remember how many decades or if it was just years or whatever, but I do think that they found part of an axe buried in the backyard, but they used to bury their trash. So they've found lots of broken dishes and jars and all kinds of things. And so they don't know for sure that it was the axe or the axe that did the crime, but they did find a part of an axe buried outside. I believe.
That sounds familiar. Yeah, that would be really hard with burying trash, you knowing what belongs to what and when, you know, when something was buried.
Right. Just curious, what do you think about this, like the new technology, like the DNA and touch DNA and things like that, and like using that to solve crimes? Like they feel like they kind of narrowed down who Jack the Ripper was based on like some DNA they found on a scarf of one of the victims or something. What are your thoughts on that kind of thing?
I mean, if someone has money for that and that's what they want to spend it on, then I mean, might as well. I don't know. I mean, it's less urgent than somebody who might be falsely accused in prison today, because, you know, obviously she's long dead. But I mean, I could see this being like a TV show on the History Channel or Travel Channel or something like that, where, you know, someone has a budget and pay to have this type of testing done. I think it'd be really interesting to see like what we would learn. Maybe there's another person who is not even on the radar that we might learn about. I don't know much about the technology behind it and like the accuracy of it, but I mean, it would be interesting if nothing else.
Definitely.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Okay, let's get into spooky Victorian ghost stories. And before we start telling any stories or I start telling any stories, I do want to ask you about like how that tradition started. I want to start with that.
Sure. So there's a very long tradition of telling ghost stories in the wintertime. This predates the Victorian era, was the case in other parts of the world, or at least in other parts of Europe, because when you think about it, in the wintertime, it would get dark early. These were the days before electricity. And so you had, you know, you weren't able to work outside. What you're able to do inside by candlelight or firelight is pretty limited. And so people would spend their evenings telling stories around the fireplace. And it began as an oral tradition. So people did not need to be literate. And there is something about ghost stories that brings people together. You know, it's a bonding experience. It's kind of like that idea of like going on a roller coaster on a date, because when you have this experience where you're scared, or even if it's, you know, you're not really in danger, it's, you know, you're bonded with the people that you're with. And so we don't really think of ghost stories as a family activity as much today, but it certainly was. And also the types of ghost stories that were circulating weren't like extremely gory horror stories like we might think of like more modern movies, more eerie or spooky, or a lot of the stories were more atmospheric. So they might not have that much of a plot, but it might be just gathering around and having one person who's maybe particularly good at descriptions. So, you know, someone's creaky bones or their skinny bony hand that's ice cold reaching out to you, or even the cliche of it was a dark and stormy night. That was setting the atmosphere. And that was part of what people liked about these stories. And so that tradition was everywhere, rural and urban areas. But as time went on and cities became more industrialized and you had people leaving rural areas and moving into urban centers, that tradition, and you know, you didn't really have family homes with fireplaces where everyone would gather around as much anymore. You might have, you know, a boarding house, or, you know, families crowded into a room in a tenement, or, you know, stuff like that. These traditions didn't necessarily continue, but I mean, they did in some places because they didn't fully die out. But when you know, at this point, you're having people come into the city, and part of what was happening during the Industrial Revolution was that the printed word was becoming more and more available. You had steam-powered printing presses, and books were still expensive, but they weren't as expensive as they were before. Or you had the penny press, and you had newspapers and other periodicals that people could actually afford. Working class and middle class people could actually afford where they couldn't before. And with more printed materials, the literacy rate is going up and all of that. And so you had these magazines and newspapers that were popular. They were, new ones were opening all the time, and they needed content. And so someone had the idea of running some of these spooky Christmas ghost stories in the newspaper. And so, I mean, some of them writers made up at that time. Other ones were stories that had been around in various forms for generations, but were, you know, committed to paper, to print, and written down. And Charles Dickens was the editor of some of the magazines at the time. And so he's responsible for publishing, not solely responsible, but he is one of the editors that sought out ghost stories around Christmas time and published them. And of course, he wrote his very famous 1843 novella, A Christmas Carol, which is the best known Christmas ghost story probably of all time. And so he did have that hand in this tradition. And so then you had cities where you had people sitting around the fireplace or around a room, and someone would read these stories. And people just had access to so many of these stories at the same time. They became kind of a pop culture phenomenon in the Victorian era. They also had books that they published that were, anthologies, basically, of a bunch of these ghost stories that were published. They were published in serials. So a newspaper one day would have part one of a ghost story, then maybe part two the next day, part three the next day, and so on. Because some of these stories, we think of ghost stories a lot of the time, I think, as being quite short, something you could tell around a campfire or, you know, to sleep over. But some of these are like 200 pages long by the time you put all the pieces together. And so, yeah, you had this, also they had this feeling of the British Empire kind of winding down at that time. So you had, it's a time of high anxiety, high fear, new technology people were also afraid of. I mean, not they were scared of the machines, but, you know, things were moving so quickly at that point that life was changing very quickly. And so there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear. And that also kind of set the stage for ghost stories being pretty popular, especially around Christmas.
So I didn't know, back in the day that was even a tradition. And I would sing it in some of like the Christmas carols. There's one that says, and scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago. And I'm like, scary ghost stories? And that's what made me start thinking about it. Like, since when is ghost stories affiliated with Christmas at all? Why do you think that it didn't carry on as a tradition? Because we have TVs and other entertainment and electricity and things now? Or do you think it's something else that made that end?
So it never really caught on in the United States. A Christmas Carol itself was very popular, but at that point, Charles Dickens was a phenomenon in the United States. He was going on book tours here. He was wildly popular. And so anything he would have written would have been popular. But ghost stories at any time other than Halloween just really didn't take off. At that point, around the turn of the century, or, you know, second half of the 19th century to the turn of the century, Halloween had already been established by Irish and Scottish immigrants as a holiday and as the time of year that we tell spooky stories and kind of get into haunted things. And Washington Irving did try in, I think it was like 1820, he did publish some short stories that took place during Christmas time that were spooky. They didn't really catch on. A few other authors did. I think Nathaniel Hawthorne might have as well, kind of taking their cues from what was going on in England at the time. But it just didn't translate. And one of the people I interviewed for the article said that American Christmas stories have just been kind of syrupy sweet from the beginning. These morality tales or stories of families and happy endings. And when we think about it, I mean, Hallmark has made an entire industry out of syrupy sweet movies for the holiday season. I mean, that's definitely not gone away. Another theory is that blame it on the Puritans. that the Puritans, obviously they were long gone by the Victorian era, but you know, they were always against anything to do with superstitions or the supernatural or folklore, and that still very much was a part of American DNA and still is to a certain extent, and kind of that being a reason why it didn't catch on. And moving forward, American pop culture kind of became the world's pop culture in a way. So even if you go over to the UK, other parts of Europe, I mean, I lived in Ireland and in the early 2000s, and one of the things we watched was Girls at the Playboy Mansion. So, which I know is a slightly different title title than you had here, but you know, that was part of our pop culture because it was on TV. And when ghost stories didn't really take off in America, it didn't really take off elsewhere. And it didn't really, you know, it wasn't part of English pop culture, even, you know, moving forward. I mean, we do still have a Christmas Carol in many different forms, preferably Muppets. And then we have The Nightmare Before Christmas, which I know is not exactly that, but it's one of the only other things I could think of that kind of fell into this category. But yeah, there is a little bit of overlap because Charles Dickens did like to imbue his stories with themes of forgiveness and reunion and repentance and using Christmas as a reason to, you know, atone for your sins and be a better person. And so that did kind of fit in with the American morality tale, like very pious versions of the stories. But yeah, it never took off here.
Yeah, I do see it's sort of creeping into our culture a little bit now. Like you said, A Nightmare Before Christmas. But this year, I even started seeing reels on Instagram of people saying that Target has a Gothmas, like all black decorations and very like kind of a little Nightmare Before Christmas and like some like gothing. I ran to Target to see if I could find any of it. I didn't see any at my Target, but I've definitely seen several people reporting on this stuff and showing photos of it and videos going down the aisles. So I think that's pretty amazing. I would love for it to make a comeback, even if it was just like a tradition to sit around by the fire or the fake fire on the TV and tell a ghost story on Christmas Eve night or something like that. I think would be so fun. But as an example of that, I have some stories here, and I'm just going to summarize these here. And then maybe after each one, we can kind of talk about what we think it means or why we think it was a story. And I hope I do okay on summarizing these here because I've never done anything like this before.
You'll be great.
Thanks. This one is called A Christmas Meeting by Rosemary Timperley. And so basically this one I love. Okay, so it's an older woman. She's living in a rented house or like a rented room of a house, kind of like a boarding house. And she doesn't have a lot of money. So she's living in a house where the landlord stores a lot of their old stuff and particularly books. And so she shares her room with all their storage stuff to get a reduced rent. And so she's spending, for the first time ever in her life, she's spending Christmas Day on her own. And suddenly, like this strangely dressed young man walks into her room and he apologizes. He's like, oh, sorry. I thought this was my room. And he starts to leave. And then he thinks for a minute and he asks her, are you spending Christmas alone? And do you want to talk? Because he's spending it alone as well. So she welcomes him in. And before you guys think this is nothing romantic or anything like that. She's an older woman. He's like a very young man, like in his 20s. And it's not like that at all. And he tells her that his name is Francis Randall and he's a writer and he's working on a book that's going to include like poetry and just like his daily diary entries. And she doesn't think that sounds very interesting, but okay, whatever. And he said he didn't go home for Christmas because his family doesn't really approve of him being a writer. And he also can't get work done when he's around family or whatever. So that's why he is home alone for the holidays. So she says to him, you know, they're sitting around chatting and she says, well, let me go make us some coffee and I have some cake, which sounds delicious. I'll take cake too. And so she goes to the kitchen and when she returns, he's gone. So later the woman finds a book in her room that's written by Francis Randall and it was published in 1852. and it contains poetry and diary entries. So she's looking through it, and one of the diary entries is for Christmas Day of 1851. And Francis Randall wrote in there that he came home to find a strange woman in his room, and he had a pleasant conversation with her until she suddenly vanished. And he concludes that she must have been a ghost. But he didn't feel frightened by her or anything like that. And then the next diary entry is written by the publisher, which notes that Francis Randall died on Christmas Day, 1851, and the unknown woman was the last person to see him alive. And it gives me chills.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
But I feel like the message here, because I feel like each of these have a message, and I feel like that message here is maybe that you're not alone on Christmas, even when you feel alone. And that so many people are also alone, but so you're not alone in that respect, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And as you were telling that, I kept going back, like, is she the ghost? Is he the ghost? Are they both ghosts? And so I guess another kind of message is, you know, things aren't always what they appear. And just as the reader or the listener, that was really interesting to kind of vacillate between who it might be, or both of them, or a lot of these stories, these Victorian ghost stories, are ambiguous and they don't have a clear, and this is what happened, the end. So I think that lends itself to telling and retelling, or reading and rereading, as it may be, because like the Lizzie Borden case, maybe if you read it one more time, you'll get that clue that'll make it all make sense. That's really interesting.
Yeah, because it is interesting. Like, are there ghosts from the future that are visiting the past? Are there ghosts, or are they always? Because I always think of them as ghosts from the past that are visiting us now. But are we visiting them too? Like, is it? It's so, and it reminds me of a story. I believe it was Andrea Perrin told it. She grew up in the Conjuring house and had like a lot of experiences growing up. But she said one of the things, and I'm not sure if I'm going to get this totally right, but one of her experiences that there was like a dinner party going on in their dining room. And it was like something that they saw in the past, like it was a thing that they saw in the past. And then it also reminds me of this other story where there's somebody who sees an old man by the fire, and he says something about these ghosts from the future or something like that. So it's like, who's haunting who?
That does sound familiar. Or I remember hearing something about, yeah, like these people who are in these bizarre clothes. And actually that is, clothes are a really big deal in Victorian ghost stories because they were signifiers of somebody's class, because you could tell immediately if someone was dressed like a scullery maid or the lady of the house or a hired hand or, you know, a lord. And so it was that identifier. Or if they were a ghost, they might be in, you know, the classic, like we think of it as a white sheet, but, you know, a burial shroud, because that's what they, you know, would have been probably buried in. And that also is another example of something that has lasted to today, is that if you think of a pop culture ghost, if it's not in a white sheet, it's probably in Victorian clothing, like a woman in white. Yeah. And, you know, that part, I think, yeah, has stuck with us too.
For sure. For sure. So many people said that.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again, after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please!
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you are sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sunrays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.
Okay, this next story is called A Strange Christmas Game by Charlotte Rydell. So a sister and brother, and they don't have very much money, they inherit this estate called Martindale, and they call it a dreary, desolate old country mansion, which I don't know about you guys, but that sounds amazing to me.
It does.
And they keep hearing these weird noises, and staff keep quitting because of all these weird noises at night. And the staff calls it the ghost, but the sister and brother don't really believe in ghosts. And they hear this tramp, tramp, banging, clattering at all hours of the night. And so since they don't have a lot of money, they just decide to accept these noises and stay because they don't believe, like I said. So at night they would stay up late, and the brother would have a gun next to him, and the sister would just be knitting and everything. And they decided they would stay up late every night because they're going to catch this ghost, or, well, not this ghost, this intruder that they think it is. And so one night on Christmas Eve, and it happens to be the anniversary of the former owner's disappearance. So somebody in their family disappeared a long time ago, and that's why they inherited this estate. The brother decides to go up to the bedchamber from the guy who used to own the house, and that's where the sounds seem to be appearing from. So he falls asleep, and he's awakened by his sister waking him up, telling him he needs to come downstairs. The people are in the parlor. So they go downstairs, and there's a fire going in the fireplace, and there's candles lit, and there's two men playing cards. And they can see the face of one of them, and they know immediately, they recognize him as being the previous owner, but in a younger age, because the previous owner has been gone for like 40 years. And they notice that he has like a gold ring on his finger, and that he has these fancy like diamond buckles that are like sparkling in the fire. And the other man that he's playing cards with has their back to him. And so one of the men claims that he won the game, and the other man claims that he just cheated. And so they're watching this take place, this fight go on, and it gets very heated. And the old owner of the home goes stomping upstairs, tramp, 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 up the stairs and to the room, and he slams the cupboard. That's the banging and the clanging. And then he comes down with two pistols, and he hands the other man the weapon, and they walk outside, and it's like a blizzardy snowstorm, and they count it off. They're going to have a duel. And the brother and sister are watching this, and it's with such anger that the other two people are having this, that they blow right past the sister and brother and don't even notice them. And so they go outside to have this duel, and they say, on the count of three. And so the previous owner of the home says, one, two, and on two, he's shot to death. So the other man cheated and killed him before the three count. And the sister is so shocked by this, she screams out loud. And then the whole scene just disappears, and there's no footsteps in the snow. Everything's gone. So the next day is Christmas Day. The sister's too distraught to go to church because of what she's seen. So the brother goes alone, and he talks to the priest about what he saw. And at first he's not really taken seriously, but they're like, well, when the snow melts or whatever later in the season, we'll come and we'll do a little investigation. So later on, they come out and they find this small clearing in the property where they find the previous owner's body, or just like probably skeleton by that point. But they find the gold ring and the diamond buckles, just like they saw in their vision. So then after they find this, then the sister and the brother, they know he's obviously murdered, but they don't know who did it. They're asking him if they saw the person, and they can't recall if they ever saw the other person's face. So then a few days later, the brother and sister are dining at a family friend's home, and the sister almost drops her water glass because there he is, the murderer. And she faints, and she's carried away. And it was an old family friend. And he was indeed the last person that ever saw the former owner alive, but he's nearly 80 now, and they decide to do nothing about it.
Wow. That's a good one.
But they saw a ghostly vision. They saw the murder take place. So it kind of got solved,
yeah,
but without justice. I think with that one, it's sort of about finding justice. I mean, well, not finding justice because they didn't get justice, but solving something. And also, I think it's also a lot about what you were saying at the beginning, kind of painting this picture. It's this dreary country, this mansion. Like, it just already, I already have a vision and I know I want to be there. So, yes. All right, you ready for another one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this one is called Number 90, and it's by B.M. Croker. Okay, so there's an advertisement. It's been up forever about this mansion, a gorgeous mansion. I love how everything's in a mansion. a mansion to rent, and it's been up for years, and nobody wants to rent it. And whoever's telling this story does not want to give out the location. They just say it's in London somewhere, and it's Number 90 is the address, but he doesn't want to say where it is. It's been empty for years and years and years because it's rumored to be haunted. And now he tells this story that 20 years ago, on Christmas, a group of friends got together for a bachelor party, and the champagne's flowing and the stories are starting to get wild and crazy. And it finally ventures into ghost stories. And the men are totally divided on their beliefs. Like, half of them believe or want to believe or think it's fun to believe. And the other half is like, no way, doesn't exist, whatever. One of the men's name is John Hollyoak, and he fiercely does not believe. And he's so adamant about it that he says, give me your most haunted house and I will stay the night in there and I will debunk it. No problem. So they tell him about the reputation of this house that nobody can rent, hasn't been rented for years. And they tell him a terrible story that happened to the family that lived there, and how the current owner that owns the place wants nothing to do with it, doesn't even live in the country. Just, if you can rent it. If not, I don't want anything to do with it. And so he says, take me there. I want to stay the night there. I'm going to debunk this and it'll be rented tomorrow after I stay there because it's not haunted. But he wants them to pay him. Like, it says £90,000. I feel like that's a lot. Back in this day, that had to be so much money.
Yeah. Wow.
Whether that was really the price or not, I don't know, but he's going to stay in this house. So he goes there, they take him to the house. He stays there alone with his dog, and he's upstairs in the room, just reading, going to pass the time and prove that this doesn't exist, when there's a knock at his door, and it's a butler and inviting him down to dinner. And he's like, yeah, yeah, right, go away. He thinks this is part of a hoax. Like, who is this person? They're just trying to get me here. So I'm not playing your game. I'm not going down to dinner. Shuts the door on the guy. A few minutes later, there's a knock at the door again. It's the butler again. Well, you need to come down to dinner. And he's like, go away. That's ha-ha funny. No, go away. Shut the door on him again. Butler comes back again a few minutes later knocking. You really need to come down to dinner. It's really important. They're all waiting for you. So he's like, All right, let's go down to dinner, right? So he goes down there and there's a whole fancy dinner party happening. And they're all elaborately dressed and from another era. And he's thinking, wow, they're really going all out on this to like trick me into thinking this place is haunted. And so he sits down and they're about to champagne toast. And instead of doing a champagne toast, he immediately tells a prayer really quick. And everybody in the room goes screaming and running out and blowing out all the candles, and everything goes dark and everybody's gone. And so he's convinced this was an elaborate hoax, the whole thing. But I didn't catch them, so I have to catch one of them. So I'm going to stay. He tells his friends, I'm staying an extra night because it's a hoax. I know it's a hoax because I saw them, but I have to catch one of them to prove it. So the next morning, the friend comes back to pick him up from the house, and he's ringing the doorbell and pounding on the door, and nobody's answering. And he, like, puts his eye through the like little peephole, and he sees another eye staring back at him. So he freaks out and he's screaming for his friend and pounding on the door enough to where he totally aroused the neighbor's suspicion. And the neighbors called the police, and the police show up and they're like, what's the matter? And he's like, and the police is like, you need to stay away from this house. This house is very haunted and we don't recommend anybody go in there. He's like, my friend is in there. My friend spent the night. He's like, your friend's in there. Oh my God, we have to hurry up and get him out. So they call a locksmith, and the locksmith comes and unlocks the door, and he goes rushing in to find the man, John Hollyoak, and his dog dead in front of the door.
Oh my. Something happened.
Something happened, and it wasn't a hoax.
No.
All right, here's another one. This one's called The Transition by Algernon Blackwood. Oh, my cat likes this one. Okay, so a man is on his way home from work. He's got his arms filled with Christmas presents. It's Christmas Day for his family. It's after 6 p.m. The streets are crowded and busy. And he steps out on the street without even thinking. He's just absent-minded, ready, you know, trying to get home. And he almost gets hit by a car. But just by the luck and like the skin of his teeth, he makes it to the other side of the street. But it's such a close call that he's like really shooken up, and he has to check all his presents to make sure everything's still intact, and because it feels like they could have been broken or something, but everything seems to be fine. And he's like thinking to himself, God, he just dodged death. And so now he's like hurrying home, and he's thinking on his way home about how sad his wife and kids would have been if he had died like on Christmas Day. And before he knew it, he was so deep in thought and so shaken up from the whole thing, he had walked all the way home. He had meant to, like, I don't know what they had in that day, hop a cab or something, or a trolley or whatever they had. But before he knows it, he's walked 3 miles and he's already home, and it just went by like that. He goes into the house. He's still shaken by the accident and everything, but he's so excited to give the Christmas presents that he got. And he unlocks the door and he creeps in. He wants to surprise his family, but he hears a bunch of noise coming from the parlor. So he peeks in the door and he sees like a ton of people in there. And then he turns and he looks, and in the vestibule, there's a ton of people in there too. There's like a party going on, or a get together of some sort. So he's sort of confused by this, and he backs away wondering what's going on, and he looks around at all the people, and some of the people are people he knows really well and people he hasn't seen in a really long time, and he's trying to put this all together. And he suddenly felt really good and like clear-headed, more than he's been in a long time, and he suddenly felt like this huge amount of love for his wife and family. Not that he didn't love him before, but he just felt this overwhelming sense of love. And he approaches his wife. He sees her sitting there with one of their children on her lap, and he approaches her and he hands these packages out towards her. And then all of a sudden, a voice from one of the people behind him says, "You can hold those out for a century and she'll never acknowledge." And he says, without even thinking, back to that person, "I know, but I'd love to do the sweet old thing." And then immediately he's confused by like why he just said that. And then his daughter, who's sitting on the wife's lap, whispers to the mom, "Daddy's here. I can feel him." And the mother jumps up and she turns white and she looks around the room and she's clearly in anguish. And again, the man says, "Here, I'm right here. I have presents for you." And then suddenly the man, she's not acknowledging him. So he looks around the room and he starts recognizing the people that are in the room with him are dead. And he starts to yell at his wife to tell her how much he loves her. And the voice behind him says, "Don't shout. They can't hear you." And his wife looks right through him, but the daughter looks right at him. And then a man busts through the door in a trench coat and hat. And he went up to the man's wife and kids, and suddenly they're, and I'm assuming he was like a police officer of some sort. The family starts crying. And then and at that moment, the man realizes he's dead. He didn't survive the accident. He was hit by that truck.
Oh, wow. That's
creepy,
grim.
Right?
Yeah.
Very grim. Okay, I have one more. Okay, this is The Summons by Ada, I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, Buesen. So, okay, it's Christmas Eve night. A doctor is working late. He doesn't have very many patients and he doesn't make very much money. And then this kind of like foreboding, scary man walks in the office and asks the doctor if he could use £1,000 to attend his deathbed for the night because he knows he's going to die that night. And the doctor is like, "Okay, well, this is, yes, I want £1,000. And yes, I would do that to attend a deathbed, but you are clearly not dying. This is ridiculous. You look a little scary, but you're in perfect health." And the man tells the doctor, "Shh, be quiet." Like he has no patience for that. And he says he's going to die at the strike of midnight. And he tells the doctor that he's received a mysterious summons from the dead and he is doomed. And he doesn't want the doctor's advice and doesn't want the doctor to argue with him. He just wants his service to stay the night in his room with him and witness what happens. So the doctor's like, "All right, it's easy, £1,000 or whatever. So I'll do it. He's not going to die. So it's fine." So they sign a contract and making sure that the doctor is definitely going to get paid after this. And so the doctor agrees and they start walking to the man's house, and they're walking through the snow, and they walk for quite a while until they come across this like beautiful mansion. Again, a mansion. I love it. And they go in through like a side door, and the man says, "You know, this took a really long time and I only have around an hour left to live." And the doctor's like, "Okay." And the man's very anxious and like, you know, worried about how much time he has left. And so the doctor thinks, well, this man's just being very anxious and hallucinating. So he pours him a glass of wine and he slips a little bit of sleeping powder into it. And he said, this will help him rest. So the man gulps down the wine and it does. He calms down and he falls asleep. And then the clock strikes midnight and the doctor feels vindicated. And so he pours himself a glass of wine because, you know, the man's still asleep and he's still alive. So the doctor pours himself a glass of wine and falls asleep. A little bit later, he's awakened by something he could not explain. There was someone or something in the room with them, and it was a dark shape. And the doctor was too afraid to even utter a sound when he saw it. And he saw it lean over the man with an extended claw-like hand that was silhouetted by the fire. And he noticed that it was missing the third ring finger. Or, well, the third finger, but I guess it's the ring finger. You don't count the thumb. And then the doctor was so scared he fainted. And when he awoke, the shape was gone and the man was indeed dead. So the doctor snuck out because he doesn't want to be like in there with like a dead man and have to like say what he saw. So there, next day or couple days later, however long, there's a big funeral and there's a young widow and she's inconsolable. And there's rumors going around of a ghostly apparition that started circulating. So the widow was like, I have to sell the house. I have to leave. I don't want to be there anymore. So the doctor sends a message to the widow. And that she's going to want to hear his story. He wants to tell her in private. Plus, he wants his £1,000. So she allows him to come over. And he said she's beautiful and like the small, teeny tiny woman. And he notices that she's wearing her wedding ring on her right hand. And she asks the doctor if he's there to tell her some absurd ghost story because she doesn't want to hear it. So she's already all upset about it. And while she's speaking about this, she stretches out her left hand. And lo and behold, she's missing her third ring finger and her hand is shaped like a claw. So he said one sentence was enough after that. He said, Madame, all I can tell you is that the ghost who summoned your husband was marked by a singular deformity. The third finger of the left hand was missing. The next morning, she fled the mansion, claiming she saw an apparition and she was never heard from again. And the doctor got his £1,000.
Ooh, that's... sounds like a murder.
Yes, I think so. But even the dying man believed that it was something paranormal or something from the other side that was coming to get him for some reason. So what went on there?
Yeah, I don't know. And how the doctor couldn't tell, like, you know, when he met the wife after the guy had died, he clearly sees a woman standing in front of him. Had he not recognized her as a woman when she was murdering her husband, he saw that ghastly figure that came out and, you know, was hovering over the bed.
It was a black shape. So she could have been wearing like a black cloak and leaning over the bed in the dark. And when she lifted her hand to kill him, however she did it, he could see the silhouette of the weird claw hand from the fire. But I think it's fascinating. And one of the things I love these stories and everything, but one of the things I think is really fascinating is obviously I had to pick some that I could summarize relatively quickly, but there were so many of them. And a lot of them were written by women. And I thought that was really fascinating. And I thought you might have some insight into why that is.
Yeah, it sort of, it's not that different from some of the women involved in spiritualism. I mean, it is, but some overlap. So women writers weren't permitted to, you know, you had a platform, which if you were writing under your own name, which was more than most women had, but you still were expected to be a woman, be a lady while you were writing. And that meant not expressing your opinions. And so a woman writer may not have been able to write a scathing takedown of whatever she saw as society's problems, but she could comment through writing ghost stories or stories of the supernatural. And so it offered a way for women to provide this social commentary in a way that was acceptable and palatable for other people to read. And I mean, the ghost stories of the Victorian era, there are a lot of them do touch on these topics of class. This was something that was a huge main theme in A Christmas Carol. You had, you know, the Cratchit family and Scrooge and the class differences there. And in this last story, you had a doctor who didn't have many patients and probably didn't have a lot of money. And for him, £1,000 would have been a life-altering sum. And you had this rich man who, you know, wanted to hire him for something. And so that could have been commentary on the power that comes with money and the potential coercion that could happen when someone offers you money to do something you might not be entirely comfortable doing. And so, yeah, writing these ghost stories gave women that type of outlet. And I read a statistic that it was two literary scholars did a survey of literature from this era that was published year round. So not just Christmas, but ghost stories and supernatural stories, and estimated that of the ghost stories published in the United States and the United Kingdom at this time, between 50 and 70% were written by women. And wow. When you, I don't know the percentage of the, of how many of the breakdown of published authors in general, but it was certainly not 50-50 or anything close to it. So the fact that women were writing this large of a proportion of ghost stories really said something. Or even like in that last story, when you look at it, which character is the one who had agency? It was the woman. She's the one who, she took the action. She's the one who killed her husband. And she's the one who had, I mean, she ultimately made the decision to flee and pay the guy the money he owed because he saw his, her claw. But, you know, in this story that was about men, it was the woman who was really the, you know, controlling the things. And so these writers could say things that they couldn't say or write otherwise.
Yeah, I think it's so fascinating. If you guys get a chance to read more Victorian ghost stories, I highly recommend it. They were fascinating. I wish I could have done more, but like I said, a lot of them are long and hard. It's kind of hard to summarize in like a quick thing here.
Yeah, they a lot of times have elaborate families. So this person's brothers, nursemaids, grandmothers, great aunt. And so, yeah, sometimes it's hard, kind of hard. You have to write down like a little map of the characters to follow along. But yeah, they're complicated sometimes.
And like you said, a lot of the stories are more about the feel and like the descriptions of things. So when you're summarizing, you don't get all of that detail, which also makes it very spooky and an interesting story to tell. But I just felt like these were a few that I could sum up relatively quickly. And it was so fun. And I hope that everybody out there enjoyed listening to their Victorian ghost stories. And Elizabeth, thank you again for doing the show. And tell everybody one more time how they can follow you on social media or go to your website and see some of the things you've written.
Sure. My website is elizabethyuko.com. Last name is Y-U-K-O. And my Instagram is Elizabeth Yuko. So I'm pretty easy to find.
Awesome. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode of Ghost Bunny Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me on my spooky adventures. And I look forward to sharing a new ghost story with you each week. Please subscribe to our podcast so you're always the first to know when a new episode is out. And follow us on social media at Ghost Bunny Podcast on Instagram for photos and sneak peeks, at Ghost Bunny Podcast on YouTube for the video version of the podcast. Bye, guys, and I hope you all have very happy holidays.